Don't you know we're talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. Don't you know we're talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds. Poor people gonna rise up and get their share. Poor people gonna rise up and take what's there. Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Oh, I said you better run, 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 run. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about the revolution.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connections Monday edition. Of course, my name is Daryl Bradford Smith. It is August the 28th, a Monday, and we are so pleased to have a returning guest. He hasn't been with us in some time. He's been very busy researching, in fact, in London's library. I'm not sure, I'll let him tell you what library, but he's a professor, a researcher, a writer, a historian, and I'm generally a powerful voice for the truth here, and he's been telling the truth for decades on many subjects. What we've invited the professor James Dickey to talk about today is about politics in the Middle East and some of the ramifications of the recent invasions and what precipitated it and what he believes will come from that and where it will end, hopefully not badly, but no one knows at this point. So his name is Professor James Dickey, and I'm welcoming you, Professor. How are you?
Okay, surviving, thank you.
Surviving. Now, where were you researching for 3 months?
Oh, in the British Library, formerly known as the British Museum, and made famous by Karl Marx. When he researched Das Kapital, sitting there in the reading room.
Well, was it fruitful? How did your research go?
It's okay. I don't write as much as I do at home, because of course I have to wait on the delivery of the books.
Mm-hmm. Are you putting together another book?
Yes, and I've been at it for 5 years. It's a history of Islam in Britain, beginning in the 8th century and down to the First World War.
So Islam has been present in Britain for time immemorial, almost.
For 1,200 years. Mm. The earliest evidence of an Islamic presence in Britain is the 8th century AD, and it's Offa's Dinar, King Offa, who built Offa's Dyke. Islam was in Britain before England was even England, when it was just a collection of states, of which the most powerful was Mercia, and Mercia had its relations with the Mediterranean trade. And King Offa, to cultivate good relations with the Muslims, pretended to be one himself and had a gold dinar minted in the name of the reigning caliph of Baghdad, who was Al-Mansur, the founder of the city of Baghdad. And that coin is now in the British Museum.
Well, so people don't know that Britain has this long history. And why do you believe that history is hidden or at least... at least underplayed in significance? What do you think is the reasoning behind it? Maybe you can give us some insights.
Well, you know, ever since the 1960s, there's been a dumbing down process across all aspects of British life, including education, and history is no longer taught in the schools. Now, that's a question of 40 years, so it means we have very few trained historians. We have plenty of sociologists and plenty of anthropologists, focus, but their interest is in the contemporary scene because their methodology is diachronic or synchronic. That is to say, if, for instance, you want to examine tribal life in Libya, you go into an oasis somewhere and you take a cross-section of that life, examining all different aspects of the society in that oasis, but ignoring history. Now, I don't see how you can do this. I think that this can only lead to corrupted conclusions.
So what you're saying is social anthropology has been marginalized as an accurate way of examining historical events.
Well, I think his historiography, as distinct from history, has been marginalized by professional sociologists and anthropologists.
And do you think it was intentional?
I don't know. But this dumbing down is found across all areas of cultural life in Britain. It applies with equal or even greater force to the museums.
Well, you know, you're not alone because the American public in about 40 years has had the same effect. And in fact, I must tell you that the education I received back in the 1960s is no longer present, no longer possible. You know, when I spoke to my son's professor, they're both honors students in college, and yet neither one of them had read many books. I couldn't believe that they read all the time on the internet, they read articles, but they've never read classic literature. They haven't studied any historical books or anything. And so what they're living is this kind of this fast-paced, let me read a quick article kind of life, but they're missing the deeper issues, I think.
Oh, I think so, yes. And this, in fact, could be deliberate to cut people off from their cultural roots because the identity of a nation or people resides in its history, in its culture. And if you deculturate that people, then you have a brainwashed nation, like what Mao produced in China or like what Lenin and Stalin produced in Russia.
From
the main currents of world history.
There is a possibility that we've had this disassociation from our past intentionally foisted on us in order to prepare us possibly now for a second phase. Because let me tell you, it corresponds quite well with the shift in policy for immigration in America and for many other things that have destroyed the family. If you recall, Professor, in 1960, a single man could support his family and his wife could be at home being a caregiver to a young child. And as the 1970s came in and we had Mr. Kissinger and the like changing social policy, you needed two people working. And today, you can't even get by with two. My point being is that we've destroyed the elements of the family, and not only that, our roots to our society as well.
Yes, this is unquestionably the case. Because the mother is no longer at home, and the children just go haywire morally. They join gangs, they go on drugs. There is no parental guidance.
That's right. And the worst thing about it is that they have replaced history and culture with modern culture, and the modern culture is void of any quality, it seems.
Oh, it's a vacuum.
Yeah.
In fact, if you read the Eternal Jew by Ford, he points out here how the Zionists were behind the promotion of jazz on the radio in America in the pre-war period, because it is an evacuation of the mind. You know, it is a scientific fact that listening to classical music raises the IQ. Listening to pop music, which is worse than jazz, lowers the IQ.
Well, you know, I got to tell you though, I love a little Dizzy Gillespie once in a while, Professor. I got to be honest with you.
Oh, I see. What a confession! Nevertheless, you are forgiven.
I'm forgiven. You know, this latest round of nonsense that has erupted in Central Asia and in the Middle East. Has, of course, everybody talking and everybody sitting on their hands wondering what's next. And what we discussed prior to this interview, you and I, just about an hour and a half ago, was the setup to this in Lebanon with the Hariri murder and how there was a very quick transfer of control of that Lebanese government and the ejection of Syria. One could have seen this one coming, is my point. What do you think?
Yes, I think the whole thing was engineered. In my view, you have to acquiesce, you have to ask the legal phrase, quis bono, who stands to benefit?
That's right.
And the party that stood most to benefit from Hariri's murder was International Zionism. And therefore, I place the blame for his demise fairly and squarely on the head of Mossad.
Well, and here's the interesting thing. We have a very well-respected journalist that works closely with us named Christopher Bolin. And Christopher did an expose on the actual assassination and some of the anomalies that were very present in the when you looked at it. I mean, there was no way a car bomb put a crater in the ground in that kind of formation. This looked like it was a pre-placed device that took this man out. Now, what would have been the reasons? I understood him to have some very, very broad-based support across many different communities, not only in Lebanon, but internationally and in the Middle East especially. Am I correct?
Well, I mean, it's true he had good relations with King Fahd, but I don't think that does him any credit, really. No, I hold no brief for any of the Lebanese ruling circles. I understand that whenever the balloon goes up, the first thing they do is, like their Israeli counterparts, they take the first plane out. As you know, the Israeli elite, whenever there's a war, they don't spend it at the front patriotically or sitting at home waiting for the rockets to arrive. They're in the Riviera or in Switzerland. In their alternative villas.
So we've got a big influx of very wealthy Lebanese and Israelis right now running around the south of France. I'm guessing.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure that's some of them.
So if you want to know,
I don't distinguish between the Lebanese political class and the Israeli political class, or the political class in any Arab country. They're all riffraff.
Well, what is the relationship in Lebanon with the Falange and the Christian Falange and the rest of them that you're aware of with the Israelis? I mean, there's been collusion with these groups for decades. What do you see as their thing that binds them together? What is the truth behind those groups?
Well, there is a community of interest, isn't there? But it goes a long way back, because there was collusion between the Christian minority, who were at that time the majority back in the 1920s, and France.
Yep.
And Lebanon is an artificial state. If you had said to MD in Damascus up till 1925, I'm going to Lebanon, people would have thought you were going to visit someone in the mountain. Lebanon was the name of a mountain. But the French detached it from Syria, and to make it economically viable, they added three predominantly Muslim provinces. And herein lie the seed of the conflict under the Lebanese Civil War, which lasted for, I think, 18 years.
So again, what they did is they fractionalized the society like they did. Well, let's move that one up to Iraq for a minute and talk about the lines that were drawn back in the beginning of the last century when the British were partitioning that state. They went right through tribal areas and cut that country up, not along cultural areas, but through cultural areas where you had Kurds living in Turkey, Kurds living in Iraq, and some in Iran. And, of course, the Shia and the Sunni were all separated out. And what they did was they almost guaranteed fractionalization at some point in the future. Am I right?
Oh, yeah. You're referring, I take it, to the Balkanization of the Ottoman Empire.
Exactly right.
You see, I think there's a great deal to be said for multinational, multicultural empires. I'm a great admirer of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and of the Ottoman Empire. Mm-hmm. You know that the last Sheikh al-Islam, the supreme religious dignitary in the Ottoman Empire, was not a Turk. He was an Iraqi. At that time, there was no conflict between Kurds. Now, just this morning, we've heard of bombs in Istanbul and in a seaside resort, and they're pointing the finger of accusation at the Kurds. In the time of Sultan Abdulhamid Sani, Sultan Abdulhamid II, there was no friction between Kurds and Turks, or between Turks and Arabs.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Ataturk coming in on the heels of actions by the Young Turks and by the Donmar and by the rest of them. In other words, that country had been infiltrated by world Zionism before we even knew the term Zionism, had it not?
Oh, a long time ago. In fact, there was a lycée, a school, on the main street of Beyoğlu, the European quarter of Istanbul, where all the embassies are. Mm-hmm. In European language, it's usually called Pera, P-E-R-A. A lycée there, which was a hotbed of Freemasonry, and it was producing all the future leaders of the Turkish Republic.
Well, what is the relationship between Freemasonry and Zionism and Jewish leadership? What is it that you've been able to garner over time? I mean, I know there's a symbiotic relationship between these organizations, but I also know that there are many people who belong to these organizations who are not fully aware of the allegiances of these groups. Am I correct?
Yes, I would concur in that. You see, the problem which the Zionists face is essentially a problem of manpower. And this is the big problem that faces Israel in the Middle East. It's got the capital to dominate the Middle East. It's got the technology. It's got the education, the technical know-how. The only thing it lacks is the manpower. Now, it's the same problem with Zionism. How can Zionism redirect global politics in the interests of some particular racial or religious group?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the answer is it needs a Gentile arm to do so, and this is supplied by Freemasonry. Now, to understand this, we have to go a long way back, you know, to before the French Revolution, to the 18th century and the Enlightenment. Now, the Freemasonry, since you're living in France, I don't need to tell you every civic building carries a Masonic slogan carved on its facade.
Yes,
liberté,
that's right.
Égalité, fraternité. Let's start with the third of these, fraternité, brotherhood. Now, four centuries, ever since Christianity became the state religion of the Roman Empire, right down until the 18th century, the Jews in Europe were looked on as a race accursed. They were deicides, and they had, according to the gospel, taken the responsibility for the death of Jesus, not only for themselves, but for all subsequent Jewish generations. Therefore, they were regarded as a people outside the law, walled off in ghettos, and nowhere did they enjoy citizenship rights. But now the basis of Freemasonry is fraternity, that all men are brothers. Now, since the Jews are demonstrably men and human, obviously, they cannot be excluded then from Masonic circles. So the Jews were the first people to be admitted into the lodges. And this way, they acquired a hold over the Gentile members of these lodges. And with the passage of time, it became ever more important. Now, the country that you are living in now has had, ever since the Dreyfus case, two governments, a visible government and an invisible government. And at one time, under Mitterrand, the two governments were headed by two brothers. That is to say, Mitterrand was head of the visible government, and his brother, General Mitterrand, the chief Mason in France, was head of the invisible government.
Ah. And so my point being this, and I know that in that same time frame, around 1750-60, there were several people sent to the United States with very large pockets full of money, and they joined Mason lodges or actually founded a few of them in the United States. And got themselves ensconced in America at that period, and some of those monies came from Mr. Weishaupt and of course this Illuminati group
and the Illuminati. Yeah,
that's right.
Yes,
now that was.
In fact, I believe that the American Revolution was not a revolution at all. It was a conspiracy. It was a conspiracy of rich landowners who didn't want to have to pay taxes.
Well,
and as for the Declaration of Independence, every signatory, or as the Americans say, every signer, was a Mason, beginning with George Washington.
Now,
I think there
have
been three American presidents who were not Masons. One of them was the one who was assassinated, and that may have been one of the reasons, that he wouldn't dance to their tune.
And what are you talking, Lincoln?
No. I don't know about Lincoln's case. No, I'm talking about Kennedy.
Kennedy, yes, he
I
was
think
an
American. The prime motive for Kennedy's assassination was that he had ordered an investigation of the Israeli atom bomb. And this investigation was, in fact, already underway. And as soon as, took over, Johnson took over, he ordered the investigation to be stopped.
And he also demanded that the silver certificates that were printed quite readily and the new Federal Reserve, the new Treasury notes that were coming out were also stopped in the same day. So every policy that Kennedy had begun to begin to move people away from the controllers were immediately reversed.
Yes.
Well, no surprises there. But see, what I do understand is the Constitution of the United States did not necessarily work in the favor of world Zionists. Was there a lapse in their control for that? I mean, because they gave a great number of rights to the individual and to the public, and those rights, if they're enforced today, could keep us out of the Zionist clutches.
Oh, I agree with you. I mean, to judge from appearances, America is the most democratic country in the world, with a complex system of checks and balances written into its constitution to prevent any social group in the state becoming dominant, which I think is very good. But it doesn't work. In reality, the country is ruled by the big corporations, and the big corporations, in their turn, are ruled by the banks, and the banks are, in their turn, ruled by invisible figures, faceless men, whose faces we never glimpse, whose names we do not even know. So
it's
the very opposite of a democracy.
Well, we know them on this show. We know Warburg, we know Goldman, we know Kahn, Loeb, Rothschild, the Honig family in Austro-Hungarian Empire. We've named them here. We've put them out.
Uh-huh.
And those names bring fear to most broadcasters, just to let you know, James.
You seem to have survived so far. I'm keeping
so far,
my fingers
you know
crossed for you.
Well, what's the worst thing they can do to me? I mean, everybody's number's up one day, isn't it?
Yes.
So I'm not going to worry about that today. Anyway, now let's go back to the Middle East here and what they've done in this most recent round of nonsense. The Israelis, they actually did not expect the rank and file southern Lebanese citizen to put up such a fierce resistance to what they did. I think they were surprised a little bit.
Well, I was surprised because in 1982 it took the Israelis only 10 days to reach Beirut, which they started bombarding from the heights behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's true that that was achieved through collusion with the Christian officer class in the Lebanese army, who often surrendered their garrisons without even firing a shot. But the same happened this time. Although several members of the Lebanese armed forces were killed in the Israeli attacks, there is no evidence of any retaliation on the official Lebanese side. Not a shot. By contrast, they spent 4 weeks hammering away at a very small sector of a Syro-Lebanese frontier and got nowhere.
Well, because the people were prepared this time, weren't they?
Well, this is it. I think that in the Middle East there is a revolution taking place, a silent revolution in which power is passing from the hands of corrupt regimes into the hands of the people, and this is a very good thing.
Well, you know, they can usurp that through deception, and that's been their best tool since the beginning is deception. The reason I have this radio program and the reason I talk to you is to expose these deceptions. And I'd like now to maybe discuss a couple of things about the intentions of these people. Is there an overall plan they have for a greater Israel extending from the Euphrates to the Nile?
Well, look, I haven't been to Jerusalem, and I don't think I would be very welcome there if I tried to get a visa. But I understand that carved over the entrance to the Knesset, there is the quotation from the Torah that we give unto you the great land all the way from the banks of the Nile to the Euphrates.
Hmm. Yeah, and they actually the map at in the Knesset shows that quite clearly without borders, actually.
Mm-hmm.
They also have some things in Scripture that maybe raise some red flags about the forces moving to the Latani River and the city of Tyre. Now, this Ezekiel passages had some references to it as well as some others. Do they often follow biblical text to do some of their things just to confuse people?
I don't know about this, because most people I've spoken to have been in Israel say it's a very secular society. In fact, they say it's a very ugly society where people smoke themselves to death, are extremely rude, and there are no manners, and there's a great deal of vulgarity. So although they are given to scripture quotation, I don't know how seriously they take it themselves. This may just be beamed at the Christian world.
Well, that's my point. See, in order to sell this worldwide, they have to make the Christian Zionists in America, all 30 million of them, believe that this is somehow a God's master plan, and that they should acquiesce to these conditions because the Messiah is going to return when the planning is done. Now, you can take a look at groups like the Chabad Lubavitch, these Lubavitchers, who are very well ensconced in America as well as Israel, and take a look at their machinations. And I get worried about this particular group because they do hold sway over the White House. They've kosherized the kitchen there. They've got rabbis from their group involved in the government. In fact, three rabbis are working at the highest level in the American government. Is there a spiritual arm of Zionism that is at work here?
I think there is, and they're busy brainwashing Bush, although he doesn't have much brains to wash, in my opinion.
I agree. Well, I see, you know, they're trying to pass on this next thing about having the Temple Mount rebuilt and having the Messiah return there and usher in a world government of peace and all this other stuff. But when you take a look at some other hoaxes around the world, Professor, such as the UFO hoaxes and the alien hoaxes, you find almost exclusively Ashkenazi Jews are behind those alien websites and alien books, almost to a man. There are almost no Gentiles that are writing these books about visitations from UFOs. And what I'm saying is that they've kind of tried to get the people to act superstitiously about the way the world is moving. And of course, many people have become duped by this nonsense.
Yeah, well, of course, ufology is the theology of our age, isn't it?
Well, it is, and I worry about it because, you know, I'm over here trying to educate.
Superstition in a scientific age takes a scientific form, and being pseudoscientific is very plausible.
Well, you're right, and I mean, and you'll see it, and people, I get emails every day, what are you, you're lying, there are UFOs, and they're going to come and help us, and all this other stuff, and I sit there, and I scratch my head, and I say, goodness gracious. We've got a large multi-million group of people in this world thinking this stuff is real, and it just muddies the waters. They're very good at muddying the waters of truth, aren't they?
Well, you know, one thing that puzzles me about ufology is why do most of these reports come from countries like Britain and America? You never hear of them from countries like, say, Burma or Ceylon.
Well, but you have to understand, too, the books, the Canadian government just accepted this book called Exopolitics, Politics of the Universe, and declared it a part of their legal system that we are going to pass laws so that when we finally do come in contact with UFOs and aliens, we've got a legal structure already built, and they've already put that into their government.
Oh, most important, so we can regulate our relations with extraterrestrials.
That's right. Can you imagine they've done this, they've codified this in the country?
No, I mean, so mad is the world, I would expect anything.
Professor, you know, and I'll tell you something, trying to keep myself planted here in reality, They throw everything on me that you could believe. They say I'm in France because I'm Roman Polanski's double, and that I'm chasing 13-year-old girls. They tell me I'm Jewish.
I think Polanski does that. Yes.
Well, he does do that, but they say that's the reason I live in France. I mean, this is the kind of slanderous attacks they'll try to do to move me off message. They don't want me telling these truths on the radio. They certainly don't want anyone getting traction on these facts. And how long have you been dealing with this disinformation coming from these people?
Well, quite long. In 1978, I got back from Pakistan to hear there was an Egyptian in London who was spreading stories about me, to wit, that I was a Jew pretending to be a Muslim, further, that I was a homosexual, and similar things. Now, this character assassination is a well-known technique employed by the CIA and by Zionist groups. And, in fact, this man had his links with these groups.
Yeah. Well, the other side of it is...
So you're not unique. I mean, we're all experiencing the same thing.
Well, but
and you know, when you sling mud, some of it sticks.
Well, but here's the interesting thing, Professor. We have come out against many people we believe have been working to try to destroy our facts. And when we point it out, of course, people claim that we're the disinformation folks and that we're the guys not trying to find the truth. And, of course, I face that as a backlash against my efforts. And of course, when you throw this out on the Internet and you've got the kind of penetration that they have, boy, it gets spread pretty far and wide.
Yeah. Well, I thank God that we've got objective historians like Irving and Farison and Zundo, whose conclusions are exactly the opposite of the court historians of the British and American establishments. And in fact, these court historians are the people who hold the chairs, who hold down the Oxbridge chairs and the vice chancellorships. So they're amply rewarded for their loyalty. But their loyalty to whom? Not their loyalty to truth.
Yeah. That's the biggest thing, the deception that is so big. Well, we've got a situation now where this last phase has not gone exactly to plan, and there is a backlash.
You mean the fiasco in Lebanon?
That's right.
And the ramifications of it are very wide indeed.
Well, but here's the interesting thing, because there's been a sea change against the next phase here. I mean, we've seen a lot of groundswell here against Israel that I don't think they expected.
You mean in France?
Well, no, in worldwide, even in America. I mean, there were enough places on the Internet and enough places in the press that showed that these people were murdering civilians almost wholesale, and they were, you know, that the aggressor was not the Lebanese, but rather the Israelis. And the fact is, that did not go over well with the public. And, I mean, while 90% of them are not seeing any truth, that 10% that did see it have become quite outspoken and quite angry.
Oh, yeah. I think this incursion into Lebanon has been counterproductive. You see, it is the first conspicuous defeat that the invincible Israeli army has suffered in 60 years. In fact, it is not the first defeat. I would say it is the fourth. The first was a single battle that took place in Jordan in 1969, which very few people know about. The second was the ignominious scuttle out of Lebanon. The third was the equally ignominious retreat from Gaza. But the fourth, and I think most influential, is this one, because this has exposed, finally, the myth of Israeli invincibility. Mm-hmm. And therefore, other Arab and Muslim countries will now be taking up a different attitude toward the situation. They will say, well, after all, these people can be defeated. Hezbollah has shown how it can be done. We can follow suit. Because remember, although they are all dictatorships and corrupt dictatorships, not even the most dictatorial of regimes can totally afford to ignore public opinion. So what you find is that those corrupt Middle Eastern autocracies do is they do a balancing act, hence all the bluster, which is designed to placate public opinion, and their real policies, which are developed behind the scenes in association with the White House and the Pentagon.
Well, I see this next phase is not being accepted by Russia and China, and we know Russia and China are as bought and paid for as all the other governments in the world. I mean, the first bank that got to do business in China from a foreign nation was Lazard Frere, and you know who owns that, right?
So, well, yeah.
I mean,
who owns France?
Well, who owns France? That's right. And so my point being, I already know where the power lies, and it's the Russians and the Chinese. They just set themselves up as diametric to everyone else, but really they're on the same team, aren't they?
I would say so, definitely. And the Chinese communists are a bunch of cynics. I mean, they're selling arms to the Arabs and to the Israelis simultaneously.
Mm. Well, I the other side of this, too. If Syria, now, see, Syria has been sitting quietly here, and of course, they've actually moved some troops, the Israelis have moved some troops and equipment as close as they can possibly get to Baqa and the Syrian border over there, and they're revving up, I think, cross-border nonsense to make it look like there's a new phase that needs to be undertaken. I'm wondering if enough accurate reports will come out of that region to stop their attempts at turning this into another phase.
Well, they won't if they follow what the British press did with a letter that I sent to three newspapers, The Independent, The Times, and The Guardian, following the Israeli attack on Lebanon. I said I cannot exclude the possibility that the Temple of Bacchus and the Temple of Jupiter, which are amongst the most finest surviving Roman remains in the world, may have suffered collateral damage. And I quoted as proof what I myself saw in the Roman cemetery in Sidon when I visited it 3 years ago. The Israeli soldiers had prized the lids off the Roman sarcophagi to look for treasure amongst the dead. And you could see the broken lids lying around. And those fractures are quite recent, because you know marble, when it is broken, a recent fracture is one that you can tell immediately from one that is old.
That's right. That's right. It's got a knife edge that's left behind.
Yes. And this vandalism would only be an extension of what they've been doing inside Israel itself for the past half century. All around about Jerusalem, there are sacred Muslim sites where lieutenants of Saladin in his wars against the Crusaders and also the heroes of an earlier phase of resistance lie buried. Now, what the Israelis are doing is trying to erase these sites, not just erase them physically, but erase them from memory, from the history books, so as to obscure the fact that there was ever an Arab presence in Palestine. And this is, of course, why, you know, that Israel was kicked out of the Archaeological Committee of UNESCO. Because although a lot of famous Israelis, like Moshe Dayan, have been archaeologists, they are not archaeologists in a sense that would be recognized by the international academic community. Because archaeology in Israel is not a scientific discipline, it's a political tool intended to prove continuous and uninterrupted Jewish occupation of Palestine, which we all know is nonsense.
Well, and they actually were a big element in the looting of Baghdad's recent problems. I mean, right after this most recent invasion, all kinds of things turned up missing and still have not been returned. And of course, they reported some of it to be discovered, but most of it is still missing, is it not?
Oh yes, definitely. And American soldiers were behind the looting, but that does not surprise me, because the late Professor Brandon, who was the professor of comparative religion at Manchester University, he was in the 8th Army during the war, you know, the British Army in North Africa.
Yeah.
And he was present when the Americans looted the museum in Carthage, and he told me how the GIs did it. He said two of them pinned the director who against the wall, whilst the rest took the cases containing the antiquities and rocked them back and forward on their feet until they fell over, smashing the glass and half of the contents, and then they rummaged amongst the contents for souvenirs. Now, there's a photograph of two Americans doing the same in the Baghdad Museum. Now, all this will, well, you know, when a fence, when a thief steals an article from your house, he only gets a fraction of the value. The man who makes the real money on it is the fence. And it's the same with these looted treasures. The money will be made on the international art market.
It's pretty sad stuff, James. I got to be honest with you. And I'm wondering what your take is on the political class in Iran and Ahmadinejad and his and Khamenei and the rest of them there. Are they genuine Muslim patriots, or are they somehow? Because look, if you go back to Iran-Contra, if you go back to weapons trading between Israel and Iran, they've been dealing with each other behind the scenes for decades. I'm wondering if some of this might be smoke and mirrors, or some of it is a genuine enmity toward each other, or well, what do we have going on there in that country?
Well, the first thing that the Khomeini government did in taking over in Tehran was to close down the Israeli embassy and then install the PLO in it as their embassy, which I think was a very witty gesture. However, I mean, we know about Iran-Contra and some of those arms deals. I think there are various factions within Iran, but I would not accuse Ahmadinejad of being in any way connected with this, because okay. Everybody knows that when he was mayor of Tehran, he wasn't one of those driving around in a big Mercedes car. He was just driving an ordinary car. So most people see him as a modest person of very deep mystical inclinations.
And how about Khamenei, the latest mullah that is running the show over there? What kind of relationships does he have? Of course, you know, the Arab community and the Persian community have been at odds with one another for a very long time, but we still have Shia there, we have some Sunni, but we have Kurds, and we also have a very large number of Persians that have their own cultural bent on religion and life. And I'm wondering what the real loyalties are behind some of the mullahs and some of the rest of it there.
Well, look, you have to understand that Iran is it's a land-based empire like Russia. Now, in the old Soviet empire, there were 118 different nationalities, of which the Russians were only one, and
that's
117
right.
who were non-Russian, some of them pretty small, like
yeah.
my wife's nationality, for instance, the Mordvins. Back in 1900, there were only 500,000 Mordvins in the whole world. That's even fewer than the Scots. I mean, there were only 5 million of us, and that's a tenth of them. So it shows how small and insignificant some of these nationalities were. Now, Iran is the same thing. There are at least five or six different nationalities there, but it's not clear that the Persians are the ruling, although they are the predominant, numerically predominant. For instance, Khamenei, whom you mentioned, is himself an Azeri. Now that means he's Turkish. And, you know, it's the Azeris who control the bazaar. And that's very important in the Iranian economy, because it was the Bazaris that brought down the Shah, since they were the economic class that suffered most during the years of the Shah's rule.
But, you know, Khomeini himself, when he lived in Paris, had the Western powers supporting much of his activity, and he was never really had any foes in the West until he was brought back into Iran. And I have to tell you, I can't think for a minute that was not orchestrated in some way. So there's got to be some red flags that have to be raised about maybe the kinds of activities that are going on. I mean, I don't know exactly, and probably no one does for sure, but I still have to speculate at some level to figure it out.
Yeah, well, of course, the best move that Khomeini ever did, or the worst move that the Shah ever did, was to exile Khomeini so that he went to Paris. Because had he gone to some obscure Muslim capital, he would have been muzzled. And it wouldn't have been possible for all those international correspondents and journalists to descend on him for interviews. Now, I've often wondered why France was so hospitable. And I can only think, you know, that there's a lot of rivalry between France and America. You go back to the time of de Gaulle. He was extremely suspicious of the Anglo-Saxons generally, and of Americans in particular. And I think America, France, through the EU has been trying to reduce the extent of American influence in Europe, and this may have been part of it.
Well, I do know that de Gaulle, did not acquiesce to NATO. He did not want any kind of foreign troop presence in his country. And the French have maintained a rather powerful military, at least in technology. And I must understand, and the listeners too, that there are undercurrents. When we talk about world Zionism, the Zionist agenda does not manifest itself the same way in each environment, and they don't have sway in the same way in each environment. Am I correct in assuming that?
Oh yeah, I would say so. Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking now at this latest round here, and I'm wondering quite seriously whether the Americans under Bolton in the UN and under the rest of these people, Negroponte and the journalist class like William Crystal and the rest of these criminals, are they going to be able to foment the next phase of this in your view?
Well, I can't say. You know, the Bible shows that minor prophets come to a sticky end. I don't want to be one of them by prophesying the future. The only people who can tell what's going to happen in the future are the Jews. I mean, if we look at that famous statement at, I think it was either the first or the second Zionist Congress, let me show you the future as if it were the rungs of a ladder leading up and up. There, 16 years before it broke out, they prophesied not only the First World War, but who was going to win it, and who would give them Palestine. In other words, the only people who can predict history are those who control history. And alas, I don't control it.
Mm. So the people sitting in those halls of power right now are deciding whether they've got the gravitas to launch the next phase, and if they feel they do, or the hubris to try it, they may in fact be planning it, and we wouldn't know until they decide to.
Yes, and one has to take into account, this hubristic dimension of their policy. The Jews are psychologically different from the rest of mankind. They have an apocalyptic psychology, and I think this is the real danger of the Israeli atom bomb. I mean, it's true that if Muslims get hold of the atom bomb, like the Israelis, they'll pause, they'll hesitate, they'll cogitate before they use it. But if the Israelis be going to lose, I think they'll drop it, because they are determined that if they go under, the rest of the world is going to go under with them. This is the danger that resides in an apocalyptic psychology.
Mm. It frightens me every day, and it frightens millions of other people around the world. What countries are best positioned contrary to these people? Is Malaysia losing its independence? I knew under Mahathir Mohamad they were able to avoid some of the pitfalls of the IMF and World Bank. And David Pidcock and Mohamed Rafik and others actually helped make that happen. I'm wondering if they are trying to get their way into that country. And are there any countries left where they are not in thorough control of the systems? Not necessarily the public, Professor, but the systems that are running the governments.
Yes.
Which countries would you say are still rather independent?
Very few. Independence is a product of power, and power can be it can be military, it can be economic, it can be cultural. For a country to be fully independent, it has to be a combination of all three. I really can't think of any Muslim country that meets all three criteria.
Mm. So there's no safe haven for the truth tellers, I guess.
No, and even traditionally anti-Semitic societies like Lithuania now have hate laws to prevent people from criticizing the Jews. This seems astonishing, but I would think that Eastern Europe, the best hope lies in countries like Poland, Ukraine, Lithuania.
Well, I'm sitting here and I avoid subjects that you know a great deal about, and I don't even study them. I don't know any of the facts around the World War II's Holocaust. I've avoided the information intentionally, and I never allow just the word Jew to come out, because I know that there are many millions of Jews around the world who are not aware of the facts behind their own leadership's decision-making. They've been lied to like many others. And they believe what they've been told. And so to hold them responsible for the flow of history would be just as unfair as it is for the rest of the Zionist Christians in America or otherwise. So I always make the caveat and say that, you know, the Jews are a duped people as well. And I make sure I talk about Zionist Jews because that is a political movement that has its roots in history. And I think the Jews themselves have been victims, probably the worst victim of their own leadership.
Yeah, I would go along with that. But do you think that traditionally anti-Jewish peoples like Lithuanians, Poles, and Ukrainians are going to distinguish between Zionists and Jews?
No, I don't think so, and that's sad, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is, because innocent people can be blamed. I mean, I know many good Jews. One of my closest friends is the leading expert in this country on Sufi music. He's married to a Japanese girl. He's tried to get as far away from Judaism as he can. Once, when I asked him where he intended to be buried, because I know the last place he wants to be is in a Jewish cemetery, like his parents, he said that since he married his wife, he has burial rights in her ancestral temple in Nagano in central Japan. So it shows you, I mean, not all Jews are like that, but there is a kind of herd instinct, you know, amongst them, that when they are threatened, they tend to coalesce and accept the leadership of a very corrupt and evil people.
Yeah, and that's what I think has kept me out of the hot seat with here in France, because I'm talking about politics and geopolitical influence and transnational, Zionism, and rather than the Jews themselves, because I think, in my view, there are bigger victims than anybody, because they've been lied to and brainwashed. And you said, as you said, George doesn't have much of a brain to wash, but many of the rank and file human beings of this planet are brainwashed, and they don't discern the differences between any of these facts either, do they?
No, of course not. I mean, if it were the Zionists who precipitated the two major conflicts of the 20th century, the Jews were the prime sufferers of that, weren't they? But it was to bring certain people and certain groups to power.
Yeah, and it worked quite well. They're quite brilliant in their planning and in their use of deception. Where did
they work through Gentile funds, and this makes it easy for them, because then the Gentiles don't suspect. I mean, Roosevelt is the obvious instance, isn't he?
Yes. Yes, he is. And now let's talk for one second about some of the people in their group that have gone off the reservation, or I think they've been returned.
People like Norman Finkelstein and
how about somebody even higher up than him? How about Napoleon Bonaparte? And they even refer to him as a Bonapartist, because he kind of went his own way on them, and so did Joseph Stalin for a time, and they didn't know what to do with him. They wanted Trotsky in there because Stalin was running his own show. And has this happened in history to them often, that the people they actually ensconce in power sometimes get a little bit uppity with them and start making their own decisions?
Yes, but sometimes these people get too big for their boots and get overthrown. I mean, you take Nasser, for instance. Nasser was installed by the CIA. The man who installed them was Miles Copeland. There was a race between the two intelligence services, the British and the American, and the Americans won. Because, as I'm sure you know, there are two wars going on in the Middle East. One is the war we all know about, and the second is a silent war between Britain and America, and it's a war over the control of resources and markets. And it's a war that America is continually winning, and Britain is continually on the retreat from. Now, Nasser, you see, he was installed by them, but he got too big for his boots, so he had to be cut down to size, and that was the Six-Day War.
Now, here's the interesting thing, because one of Nasser's proteges was Saddam himself, wasn't he?
Yes.
In the Baath Party formation,
he kept up this bloodthirsty monster. He paid him an allowance when he was living in Cairo.
Oh, boy, the webs we weave. And you know, it's interesting that almost no one talks about these histories, and the fact is they are there to be discovered. And when I do this digging, I find facts out that nothing shocks me anymore, James. I got to tell you, I'm not shockable anymore. Although at times I am terribly disappointed. I'm wondering, are we waking up? Has Pandora's box been opened? And are we beginning to make some headway against the hegemony of certain groups?
I don't know. You know, Americans are instinctive optimists. But sometimes when I look at the world, I think, really, who do you call him? That Japanese American who said we have arrived at the end of history is right, but not in the sense he did. I sometimes think we're looking back over our shoulder at the whole expanse of history, and in front of us is just the abyss.
Yeah. I worry about that, and I got to tell you, discussions like this, I don't know how often you get to talk like this. Is it often enough that you get to somebody who knows as much factual information as the people that are listening?
No, and certainly not on the radio or in the media. They may know it, but they don't voice it.
Well, you know, this is an opportunity for everybody listening today, because I have spent a couple of years now. You've spent decades. I've only been studying this stuff for a couple of years, Professor.
Yeah, it's astonishing how much you have assimilated in all that time.
Well, I've had some good help, huh? I've had help from the best. A lot of people have looked to me as somebody who's willing to fight the real fight. So what ends up happening is I get some good information. Now,
there's no excuse for people not knowing about this, because there are lots of books on the subject, and the facts have been analyzed by people of unchallengeable integrity and veracity. But these books you do not find on the shelves of the public libraries, and you don't find them in the big book in the bookstore chains. You have to go looking for them.
Well, I propose that everyone out in my listening audience continue their digging and their understanding of facts. And I want to thank you for spending this time with my listeners. And I want to invite you back maybe in a month or so, if you've got the time, and we'll pick another subject maybe that we can enlighten people about. It could be Boer Wars. It could be the Oppenheimers going down into South Africa, or it could be the relationship between South Africa and Israel. It could be anything. Freemasonry, if you'd like, any kind of subject, because every time we shed some light on a dark corner, we're helping people understand the bigger picture, I think, and you've done that today. You really have.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor. That's Professor James Dickey, ladies and gentlemen, from Scotland, and I want to thank him very much for spending the time with you. And the next show that we do, you know, I don't know who I'm going to be inviting on, but I can promise you it'll be the best I can get for all of you to learn something new. This battle that we're all facing is really one for our survival, survival of our culture and possibly even our lives. And I urge everybody to take it as seriously as all that, and maybe look into all of these facts for yourselves. Confirm or confirm these facts for yourself, and then you make the decision. But until our next broadcast, ladies and gentlemen, this is Daryl Bradford Smith saying goodbye. Be well. Bye-bye now.